Welcome to Worlds Apart. One handshake at a time, that used to be the motto of citizen or people's diplomacy, a movement that originated in the latter years of the Cold War and is often credited with helping to bring it to an end. Does it stand a chance nowadays when Russia and Western countries have cut their diplomatic exchanges to a historic minimum? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dmitry Laskaris, a lawyer, journalist, and activist from Canada. Dmitry, it's good to see you. Thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I know you've been here in Russia for slightly less than a month. Mm-hmm. Can I ask for a rough estimate of how many Russian hands you have shaken so far?
I would say over 100 from across the span of generations and political orientations, and it's been a fascinating and I would say surprising experience.
Now, I know that you are a successful lawyer from Canada. You made a name for yourself in the corporate world, and you know, it's rather counterintuitive that a person of your professional path would spend time and money and put his own reputation, both professional and personal, on the line in order to come to this country, the military defeat of which is still the stated policy goal of your government. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm.
Well, although, yes, it's true, my background is in securities law. I started on Wall Street and then became a securities class actions lawyer. That has little to do with my origin as a human being. I am the child of two Greek immigrants, neither of whom had a high school education, who came from Greece in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Civil War in Greece in the 1950s. So I have very humble origins, and I have never forgotten that. By the time I had practiced law for 25 years, I was economically secure, and I felt enormously grateful for that fact, and I had to think hard about how I could compensate or give back for my extraordinary good fortune. And so I became an activist, a journalist. I don't do that as a living, it's more a passion. And when this war erupted and I became absolutely convinced that this was the most, and I hope I'm wrong, but that this is the most dangerous moment I think humanity has ever confronted, not just because of the war, but because of the context in which this is happening, climate crisis and so forth, I asked myself, how can I contribute? How can I do something, anything, to try to diffuse the tension? And so I came to Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as I understand, this is your first time
Yes.
in this country, and you've been not only to Moscow, but also to Crimea, which the Canadian government does not recognize as part of Russia. And before asking about your impressions, I want to ask you as a lawyer, do you think you will face any legal repercussions for traveling to that place?
Well, I shouldn't. As a lawyer, there's
Have you checked?
Yes, of course, yes. And I've done nothing that anybody could plausibly claim to be a violation of Canadian law. Nonetheless, the authorities don't always act in accordance with the law. So there's some possibility, and I hope that this doesn't materialize, that people in positions of power will try to exploit that position in order to intimidate me and make an example out of me and prevent others from following in my footsteps. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's not a possibility that I exclude, because I'm realistic about how the political system operates in our country.
And even if the government doesn't have a case against you, I mean, Canada is home to a very large Ukrainian diaspora, some of whom are direct descendants and diehard apologists of very radical Ukrainian nationalists and Nazi collaborators. I wonder if it's safe to do something like that at a time when people have actually been not only intimidated but assassinated because of standing against the mm-hmm. Ukrainian authorities or, you know, Western authorities who support them.
Well, in Canada, it's true that there is a very large Ukrainian-Canadian community. I know some people in that community who are committed to peace and who are who do not identify at all with the establishment of that community. But it's true that as a whole, and particularly at the elite level of that community, and I'm talking particularly about the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, they are quite right-wing and quite militaristic in their view. Up until now, there's has not been, to my knowledge, any acts of violence against people who have opposed what I regard as a proxy war. What I'm more concerned about is reputational assassination, and not from Ukrainians, but from the mainstream media and the political class. And as a matter of fact, on Monday of this week, the flagship newspaper of Canada's largest newspaper publisher, the newspaper is called The National Post, published a front page story about me, basically smearing me and accusing me of having come to Russia in order to whitewash the crimes of its government. And fortunately, because of my painful experience with the media in the past, I recorded the entire conversation and posted it on my my website and invited people to decide for themselves whether or not that's what I had done.
Do you think it makes sense to pursue them not only in the court of public opinion, but actually sue them for saying what they said about you?
I've actually had occasion to do that. Because of criticism that I leveled against supporters of Israel in our country, I was accused of being a supporter of terrorism. In 2017, by a very, very strident pro-Israel group, and I sued them for defamation, and ultimately the case settled, and they retracted their statements and paid some compensation. But I also know, as somebody who has experience with defamation law, that Canada's it's a difficult path to recover compensation in a defamation action. Mm-hmm. And I understand why. The government has tried to strike a balance between free speech and protecting reputations. So I am very, very hesitant about using the courts of law to protect my reputation. I'd rather do that by means of debate.
Mm-hmm. Now, returning to the means of debate, how was Crimea? What did you expect to find there? And what did you find there in actuality?
Well, first of all, I didn't know that Crimea was so beautiful. It reminded me very much of the south of Greece, where I now have a home in Kalamata.
And there are many connections with the
There are. I didn't know that either. And I visited the community, the ruins of Chersonissos in Sevastopol. So the beauty of it was a surprise to me. The fact that the war was... Now, I spent a fair bit of time in Yalta. I didn't really see any overt signs of the war there. But at the same time, you could tell that people were somber. And that it wasn't at all a festive environment. I think people obviously are very conscious of the war. When I went to Sevastopol, there was actually an attack. I don't know exactly what happened, but the air defense systems were activated. And then I went to the north of of Crimea, to the border of Kherson, and visited a refugee center. And there I felt the proximity of the war much more. There was military equipment everywhere, a high state of alert, security. And the refugee center workers that I spoke to didn't want their faces to be exposed to the camera. So there, you know, I felt, as I say, the proximity of war more. But I never got closer than 50 kilometers to the front line. And having seen what I've seen, I can't imagine how difficult it is to actually live in close proximity to the front line.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it's even more difficult for the people on the other side, in Ukraine or... especially in Kyiv and those areas where the war is still going on. Now, the Ukrainian government's definition of victory still includes retaking Crimea. I understand you're not a military specialist, but having been there, do you think that's a realistic expectation, either in strategic terms or in terms of hearts and minds? Because I'm sure you've spoken to people there.
Yes. I don't think it's remotely realistic in either sense. I did not speak to a single individual there who expressed a desire to see Crimea reunited with Ukraine. I spoke to many people who were passionately opposed to that idea and declared their determination to offer themselves up in resistance if that were actually attempted. In terms of the military reality, you're quite right, I'm not a military specialist, but I learned as I approached the border with Kherson that the only connection between, from a land perspective, between Crimea and Kherson are two very narrow peninsulas, and we traveled through one of them, and there were several lines of defense, anti-tank obstacles, extensive trench works, They were wide open. There was no tree cover at all. There were two large bodies of water on either side. And it was apparent to me as a layperson that any attempt to enter the peninsula through these two narrow corridors of land would be disastrous. I think, and it's, you know, I don't need to rely only upon my own judgment as a layperson. American military officials have begun to acknowledge openly that this is a pipe dream. And I think that it would be suicidal, both from a political perspective and moreover from a military perspective, for the Ukrainian government to attempt to retake Crimea.
Why do you think the Ukrainian government is continuing to press that pipe idea? Why do you think they need it?
Well, I think I spoke to a gentleman, his name was Sergei Gorbachev, who I understand no relation to Mikhail, the former president of the Soviet Union. He is a journalist now, a military correspondent. I met him in Sevastopol, and he said, you know, it's well understood that he who controls Crimea controls the Black Sea. So I imagine, you know, that this is a matter of strategic importance to the Ukrainian government. There's obviously tremendous utility in controlling Crimea geopolitically. I think there's also a tremendous amount of prestige attached to it, and that they feel that if they could retake it, that that would be a resounding victory for the state of Ukraine. But again, this is, I think, highly irresponsible and something that they should, in the interest of peace and the safety and security of their own people, because even if they retook Crimea, that would probably result in lasting instability within Ukraine.
Of course, there's a huge elephant in the room here, and this is the position of Western countries that are funding this war, and that I'm sure agree with the assessment of your journalist friend that whoever controls Crimea controls the Black Sea, because that issue, that strategic issue, was very much discussed when the Yanukovych government was toppled back in 2014, and the Ukrainian authorities started talking about evicting the Russian fleet from there. I wonder, how do you understand the genesis of this whole conflict? When does it start for you?
Well, I think it's been in the making for decades. I think there have been attempts by the West, although they were unsuccessful and very covert for a long time, to create instability and division within the relationship between Ukraine and Russia. I think it goes all the way back to the 1950s, frankly, when the United States government was covertly funding and supporting and trying to invigorate ultra-nationalism in Ukraine. But I think the really pivotal event was the overthrow of Yanukovych. Here you had a president who was, he was democratically elected, whatever his flaws may have been, and he was certainly not a perfect leader.
Well, he didn't have the appearance of Justin Trudeau, but Trudeau also has some very questionable governing skills.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. But in any event, he was democratically elected, and his support became, as I understand, principally from the southeast of Ukraine and Crimea. And everybody refers to him as a puppet of the Putin government. I think he was simply doing the responsible thing and trying to maintain good relations with Russia, which is what his supporters wanted. When he was overthrown, effectively what happened was the vote of the Ukrainians who supported him was stolen from them. And this just cascaded into one tragedy after another, culminating in open warfare between Ukraine and Russia. To me, that was the pivotal event.
Can I ask you something? Because you mentioned the early 1950s when the American authorities were stoking Ukrainian nationalism in the Soviet Union. And at that time, the Canadian authorities, as well as the American authorities, were giving refuge eagerly to the, you know, Nazi collaborators, Ukrainian nationalists. And it's hard for us to understand that, why something like that would be happening. Because having traveled to the United States, having been to Canada, having been to Ukraine many times, we are not that much different. Why do you think it's so easy for the West and consequentially for Ukraine to demonize this country and its people? Because, I mean, we have our flaws, but we are not much worse than you.
Well, I wouldn't say you're worse at all. I mean, we're all human beings, and my interaction with Russians has convinced me, and admittedly, I'm no expert in Russia, but that they're very decent people, and if you get to know them, they're very warm and generous people. And I wish that I could, you know, bring thousands of Canadians over here with me in order to enable them to interact personally with the Russian people. And I think it's very important when we talk about the conflict between our countries to distinguish between people-to-people relations and government-to-government relations. The government of Canada does not represent, as you've implied yourself, I think, the will of the people. So, for example, a recent poll in February showed that only 32% of the population support the transfer of weapons to Ukraine at this stage. They've had enough. Only 32%. Every single member of parliament, as far as I know, some 338 parliamentarians in Canada, support publicly the transfer of weapons to Ukraine. So what is happening at the elite level, at the political level, is effectively Canada has outsourced its foreign policy to Washington, and Washington's agenda is one of global hegemony. Washington will not tolerate, and I think they're not even subtle about this. You know, they will not tolerate a global rival. And Russia is perceived as a country that is both potentially a powerful rival and also determined with the current government not to submit to the will of the Americans. And then you have China.
Because we want to be ourselves. I mean, yes. we don't want to impose our will on the Canadians, but we want the right to live on our land as we please. Mm-hmm. Dmitry, because it's my studio, I take my right to call for a short break, but we will be back in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dmitry Laskaris, lawyer, journalist, and activist from Canada. Dmitry, just before the break, you mentioned that only 32% of the Canadian public support arming Ukraine, and you can argue that it's a relatively low level of passive support, but, you know, people's opinions change depending on what media are trying to shape with their narratives. And I want to quote Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, who said about a year ago when this conflict was in its opening stages that the world's democracies can be safe only once the Russian tyrant and his armies are entirely vanquished. What do you think would be the cost of such safety for the Canadian society? Because if Ms. Freeland wants to vanquish the Russian army, she will have to, you know, put in more than just words.
The cost will be incalculable, and possibly the ultimate cost, which is nuclear war. I don't think the government, you know, despite what's said in the West, I don't think the government of Russia has any desire to use nuclear weapons. But their policy, as is the policy of every nuclear-armed power, is if existentially threatened, they will consider the use of nuclear weapons.
But even if not existentially threatened, I mean, your country is sending weapons to my country.
Yes.
And those weapons are being used not only to kill soldiers, but Ukraine uses terror tactics a lot.
Yes.
There have been several terrorist attacks in Crimea and in some Russian cities. So indirectly, the West is supporting terrorists.
Absolutely. And, you know, Interpol also warned the head of Interpol a few months ago that these weapons are ultimately going to end up in the hands of criminal organizations. Just last week, the French authorities arrested two ultranationalists who returned from Ukraine with prohibited weapons in France. So you have that issue. You have the issue of the economic destabilization. I think it's quite clear from there was an excellent article by James Galbraith, an economist in the United States recently, which showed that the sanctions are doing more damage to the West than they are to Russia. So you also have, I think, just growing in political instability from the economic impacts of this. There's a range of ways in which this war will ultimately destabilize the West.
Well, I think it's already doing that. And I want to mention two other prominent American political voices, Richard Haass and Charles Kupchan. two big names in poli-sci circles who recently published an article in Foreign Policy calling for the United States to change its tactics and not allow Ukraine to define the end goals of this campaign. Now, if the Americans withdraw, and they have a track record of simply abandoning the mm-hmm. allies, if they do that for electoral, political, economic, whatever reasons, what do you think the Canadian authorities are going to do? Do you think they will continue sticking for no. Ukraine, so to say?
No, I would be astonished if they do that. First of all, the appetite, if the Americans stop supporting this travesty, I think the public, whatever public support exists for it will evaporate immediately. But I think that the Canadian government understands perfectly well that the only way this war can be sustained is by massive support from the United States. If that goes away, Canada will become a bit player and will be forced to withdraw.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's where citizen diplomacy can play a role, especially given that right now the exchanges between our countries are almost frozen, especially between Canada and Russia. And the whole movement itself originated back in the 70s, in the 80s, when athletes, artists, businessmen started, you know, coming from the West to Russia and vice versa. And I remember that back at the time, the West supported this movement, thinking that it was a nice soft power tool. Why do you think there's so much opposition to it now? Because as a Russian, I cannot go to Canada right now. Mm-hmm. I cannot get a visa. My credit cards don't work there. So why do you think Western authorities are not welcoming things that yeah. you do, for example?
Well, because interaction results in a revelation of the truth. When you actually interact with the so-called enemy, you realize what in fact is going on. It's very easy in Canada, because so few people have actually ever been to Russia or, for example, to China, to misrepresent what's going on there, because they don't and probably never will have the opportunity for direct interaction with Russians or Chinese in their own country. And so they lie relentlessly about this. It's actually quite astonishing, and they get away with it, frankly. And, you know, going back to that poll where it's 32%, one imagines how low the number would be if people were actually being told the truth about this conflict. So I think they're trying to sever relationships with direct people-to-people relationships in order to be able to sustain the propaganda narrative. And I must say, you know, when they immediately banned RT, I come here today to speak to you, Oksana, as an act of defiance, because I cannot object strongly enough to the idea of depriving people of access to Russian media, even if they are government-funded, even if they have a pro-government perspective. So do ours.
But it's not just the media. You know, on some level, I can understand, not that I approve of that, but I understand why they would see RT as sort of as a propaganda tool, because we do express often the position of the Russian government. We do make distinctions between you know, news and opinions, and we try to be transparent. But it's politics, after all. But when they try to ban Russian culture, classical Russian culture, I mean, things that were studied in American or Western universities for decades, this is something that defies yes. any critical thinking.
Yes, it amounts really to Russophobia and outright racism, to be perfectly blunt about it. I saw a report yesterday that a Russian tennis player was prevented from taking a flight to a tournament on Polish Airlines simply because she was Russian. I think this is insane. I mean, why? Even if you believe that 100% the narrative of the West about the legality of this war, why should she be held prejudiced by virtue of her nationality? It's an effort to demonize all things Russian.
Now, one of the pioneers of citizen diplomacy, physicist Robert Fuller, who traveled frequently to the Soviet Union back in the 70s and 80s, believed that this is something that sort of a form of personal responsibility, that this is something that people can bring to the world. And he applied it not only to the Soviet Union, but also to many other countries. I wonder if you have any goals or ambitions or wishes to travel to some other places that the West describes as the axis of evil? Have you been to Iran? Have you been to Syria? I don't know.
As a matter of fact, I resolved last year to visit within the next 1 to 2 years every official enemy of the West. Mm-hmm. That would take me to China, and I specifically want to visit the province of Xinjiang. Oh. Because the West alleges that a genocide is occurring there. I want to go to Iran within the next year. I've already been to Venezuela and it covered the attempt to overthrow the government of Maduro. So that one's that initiative's been taken care of. But yeah, this is a part of a broader project, which I'm personally able to undertake. I'm very fortunate to do that, to try to open the eyes of the West to the official enemies of the West.
What kind of feedback you're getting from people who follow you on social media or in writing?
Sharply divergent reactions, shall we say. So there are people who are extraordinarily supportive, people who've come out of the woodwork, and some of them, I identify as an eco-socialist. Some people who would normally be my political opponents have privately communicated to me that they're very, very impressed by this initiative. Then you have people who are sort of, they don't know what to make of it, and they want to have a good faith conversation and try to understand why I've done this. And then there are people who are just, as I say, engaging in open reputational assassination. And that's been the most difficult part of this whole thing.
Now, one of prominent Russian Orientalists recently suggested that at the core of this conflict, or at least one of the reasons for this conflict, is the fact that Russia and the West see social progress in very different terms. For the West, it's all about, you know, expression of liberties and some abstract ideas. And that's perhaps a consequence of pretty comfortable lives that you guys have had over the last couple of decades. For Russia, for China, for Venezuela, for many of those countries, it's much more about access to social infrastructure, giving people basic social services, ensuring, you know, some bread and butter issues. I wonder if there is any truth to that as far as you are concerned, and what does it take for a Westerner to sort of take off this judge code, leave it behind, and try to look at the society the way it is without applying all those judgmental frameworks of how things are supposed to be, you know, having, I guess, basic compassion for the country and the people, and seeing how far they have progressed from, let's say, 10 years ago.
Well, you know, this notion of Western exceptionalism is so indoctrinated into the population of the West that it's very difficult for them to grasp that maybe people don't attach the same importance to material benefits and well-being as they do. One of the things that struck me about Russia, and I know there's a large proportion of the people here who don't really, they're not avid Orthodox Russians, but the level of spirituality among the Russian people has quite impressed me. I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church. I'm not a religious man. So seeing this level of commitment to Orthodoxy is a little bit unusual for me, and I said that's made a big impression on me. The first 2 days I was here, I spoke with a Russian living in Moscow now. He's a high school teacher, and he actually did a PhD at Oxford in Spanish literature, of all things. Came back to Moscow, and he recounted to me what the Russian people went through with the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 90s and how terrible that was. And how things have, the stability that has, and the cohesion, level of social cohesion that has developed in the 20 years since. And he said, you know, for Russians, that matters a great deal more than profits, a great deal more than, you know, the latest gizmos from your Apple iStore. And that's made it be difficult for you to comprehend, but we just have a different value set. And based on what I've seen, I think that's true. And we as the Westerners, this is why I say, I think personal interaction is so important. If people could actually meet Russians living in Russia who don't necessarily agree with the Western narrative about their country, they would understand that their values are not quite the same as our values.
Well, Dmitry, we have to leave it there, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that. And good luck on your journeys.
Thank you so much, Oksana. Take care.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.